Business is simple. It's just not easy. We focus on three things to help you run and grow your business more easily: talent, sales, and how to scale. Can it be that simple? Talent. Develop a robust recruiting, vetting, and training process to help capable people and then help them to become who and what they want to be. Sales. Have a logical go-to-market strategy. Build the sales and marketing structure and plan around it, and then attack and execute the plan with fanatical consistency. Scale. Know where you're going, why you're going. Share with others why they would want to join you. Be clear on who's allowed to join you and what they'll need to do to stay on board. Anticipate roadblocks. Avoid them before you get stuck. And then when you do hit one, and you will, stay calm, problem solve, and find resources to get unstuck. Sounds simple, right? Simple to understand, but not easy to do. Join us as we focus on the tips and tricks and hacks for running a profitable, hyper-growth business. We'll share real-world horror stories and celebrate the victory sagas that will inspire you. This is the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show.
Hey everyone, this is Brian Whittington with this episode of the Talent, Sales, and Scale Show. We have Ben White on with us, who is newly recovered from COVID-19. So thankfully, he still can't taste anything, but he's good enough to be on here and strong enough to be running tomorrow. So Ben comes to us to talk about how in the world do we hire post-COVID? Well, I guess we're still in the throes of it. Post-shutdown, although we're still not out of it yet. But how do we look at talent strategy, hiring people in this crazy environment? So what's talent look like in 2021? So Ben works with an organization called Titus. Is that correct? Did I pronounce that correct?
Yep, it's Titus Talent Strategies.
Titus Talent Strategy. And then he's also on YouTube, hashtag him, Ben Talks Talent, willing to come out and talk to your group. So with that said, welcome, Ben.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk some talent today.
Yeah. So one of the questions that we always ask here is, you know, everybody thinks that they know how to hire. Everybody thinks that they know how to spot talent, right? They have that great gut reaction or whatever the case may be. So I guess the question number one is, why in the world should we listen to you about hiring practices in 2021?
That is a great and fair question. And I would say my response to that is the reason why anyone should listen to me on anything talent acquisition, recruiting, and hiring is probably the well-rounded experience I've had. So I've spent the last 11 years in talent acquisition. I've done that for two Fortune 500 companies. I've done it on the corporate side as a corporate recruiter. I've done it on the agency / headhunter side, doing third-party recruitment. And I'm now in a leadership seat where I manage the work of a team of recruiters and a large book of business that's, you know, across the US and a little bit international. So I eat, sleep, and breathe and live recruitment. And I've done so every day for the last 11 years. And that's why.
Got it. So you have a little bit of experience is what you're saying.
I've done it a little bit here and there. I've dabbled.
All right. Got it. Well, so I suppose question number one, especially since you're working for an agency, why should I use you? I mean, let's face it. It's an unfortunate reality, but the reality is there's so many people displaced right now. I would think I just throw something up on Indeed or a job board and people are going to be flocking to me. So why in the world should I, engage with an agency?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a unique time to answer this question because right now there are more people displaced than there probably have been in quite some time. That being said, what my company specializes in doing is passive candidate recruitment and reaching out to the top 25% performers in the market. So the reality is the people that we submit and ultimately get hired for our clients are people who are never going to be on the job boards. They probably weren't laid off, unless of course they were in hospitality or travel and leisure. But for the most part, these are the top 25% performers who are just never going to be available to you unless you go to them, you engage them, you pitch them an opportunity, and you shepherd them to a process. So yes, you can absolutely find people. You can post things online right now, people will apply. But our clients still want us to find them, those top 25% performers. who can come in and make a significant impact and move the needle for their organization. That's one of the reasons.
Well, so how are you determining if they're the top 25% of the performers?
That's a really good question. And we have a very robust process for determining that because it's important. One of the things we do that most other talent agencies won't ever do and would probably shudder at the thought of doing is we guarantee the performance of our candidates for a year. So We don't care about, hey, did you hire this person? We care about day 366. How did they do? Did they accomplish the job you wanted them to accomplish? That's kind of what we're getting after and what we're guaranteeing. So, you know, so that's kind of the end goal here. So as far as how we determine that, right? Because that's a bold claim. That's a bold guarantee. What do we do to make sure that, you know, people actually live up to that? So we have a very in-depth screening process. We use predictive index to do, we make a profile for them. So we find out the behaviors. It's kind of an in-depth process, but let's say hypothetically, you wanted to hire a salesperson for your team and you have 20 salespeople on your team. We would take the three best people, have them take an assessment, build a profile based on their behavioral patterns. And we would use that as one of the ways we measure candidates, right? We'd also get their cognitive score. We'd take them through a battery of questions that determine head, heart, and briefcase. That's kind of our methodology for determining if someone's a top 25% performer, right? We use predictive index to measure the head. We find out your core values and we try to find value alignment with our candidates and then briefcases of performance. We look for a track record of performance. We look for people who have the achiever pattern. It's basically a very in-depth process that really nails down whether or not this is the type of person we can confidently say this is a top performer.
Yeah, so a lot of people aren't going to be too terribly familiar with predictive index. So what would you describe as the achiever, or what did you call it?
The achiever pattern. Now the achiever pattern is actually separate from predictive index. The achiever pattern is something that recruiters look for, and it's a track record of hitting goals, being promoted within their organizations, and just achieving in their career. So when you look at someone's LinkedIn profile and you see that they've been at a company for 4 years and they've been promoted 3 times, that right there is an indicator of an achiever pattern. That is someone who is growing. They're demonstrating success and they're being valued at their company and being promoted. You know, if you look at someone's LinkedIn profile and they have 3 different jobs in 4 years for 3 different companies, and then you contrast that with somebody who's worked for one organization and been promoted 3 times, you feel pretty differently about that. So that's kind of how I would describe the achiever pattern. That's one of the things I'm looking for.
So I like that. So the achievement pattern is a person that's promoted, not, you know, because we always joke around, you can have 20 years of experience, but never get past 1 year because you just keep moving every single year. So you really never get that in-depth, robust knowledge. So you're suggesting that achievement pattern is more a person that stays put and is promoted. Some studies, I think, coming out of the Bridge Group, I'll give them credit, but I might be wrong here, admittedly, suggest that if somebody leaves a job sooner than 2 years out, I forget the percentage, but they're so much more likely to leave you in a very short order and not perform as well. I'm not sure if you've seen that or heard of that at all.
I haven't, but you've made me want to go look it up and read it. And quite frankly, it's probably pretty spot on. The average tenure in the US is 3.1 years. So when you look at somebody who's been there for less than 2, you're probably looking at someone who's at 50% of the rate. They're doing half that. And I try to hear a story when I'm recruiting or I counsel my recruiters. When you talk to people, find out the why, right? Because there are legitimate reasons for leaving an organization. But when you notice a pattern, you really need to dig in. There's not always a good reason. And there could be cause for concern. So yeah, there's probably a lot of validity to that.
Yeah, so what are the biggest reasons that people are leaving today? I mean, because I would think that there has to be a little bit of trepidation, right? Because if I leave my position, there's not tons of people hiring right now, or I might be wrong on that.
Yeah, you know, it's so weird because I'd say yes and no. I have, my company has actually had the busiest December we've ever had in our 10-year history, which is such a weird thing to say after the July we had. To be like, oh yeah, we're hiring like in double digits right now. We're building teams. I have a person who's in a final interview with my company to join my team today. And we're going to be hiring more. So yes and no. I mean, I think depending on the industry, right, you're going to see different levels of recovery and different you know, progress along that, whatever course that is they're taking to recovery. But I would say, yes, there are certainly people hiring. That being said, it is a competitive market. So if someone is leaving, I have to imagine, you know, it's for a, you know, it's for a very bad situation they're trying to escape. What I see a lot in terms of why candidates are leaving, to answer your original question, is I see a lot of people who, you know, they are doing the work of multiple people now, right? So maybe they, you know, their team, their organization downsized, and they've been asked a lot, right? You know, during this, you know, during a very stressful year, their job has been more stressful. So I see people leaving a lot because it's just been a hard time, and they're burdened with the work of multiple people. You always see people leaving because, you know, they don't connect with leadership, you know, bad boss. You see a ton of people leaving because they don't feel like they're properly recognized in their organization. And just for the prospect of growth, you know, there are companies that are growing, there are companies that are not. That divide is probably more clear than it's been in a while. And if you're in a company where you feel insecure about the stability and you see that there's hiring taking place, it's a pretty strong motivator to move.
Got it. Well, so now you had talked about that it's a pretty competitive marketplace out there for talent. So
yeah.
How can that be true whenever there's still so many people that are not hiring? Are you saying that now in December, this new year, the doors are opening up, or are we back to 2020 pre-pandemic levels? I mean, what are you seeing out there?
Yeah. And let me clarify that. When I say it's more competitive, I mean, it's more competitive for candidates. If you're interviewing for a job right now, it is clearly more difficult than a year ago. Just because right now there are more candidates in the market. There are people who were displaced who probably, if not for a pandemic, never would have found themselves in this situation where they're looking for a job. There have been really good people who are let go. So while there is a lot of hiring going on, it's a weird situation to be in, because again, you know, to kind of echo what I just said, it was the most like busy December in my company's history. You know, we have 20 roles right now that we can't even work on, because we just don't have the people for it. We actually have a physical backlog of roles, but there are still a ton of people who are unemployed. It's kind of a weird in-between area that I think we're in. So when you're a candidate and you're going to interview for a job, you're going to find yourself up against multiple people who are very well qualified, like you are, and there is a small margin for error. So when I say it's a competitive market, that's what I mean. From a candidate's perspective, right now, it is a challenging time to be seeking a job.
So what are the specific roles that you're finding have the most competitiveness, right? Because you can walk down and get a job anywhere depending on what it is, right? So I always jokingly say your income is directly proportional to the size problem that you solve. So what are the problems that we're solving? What roles are they hiring for?
Yeah, you know, what I see where the roles are really competitive is the roles where there is a lack of specialization, right? So if I have clients who say, Ben, go find me a front-end developer who specializes in Drupal, right? That there are not going to be a ton of those people, right? So that is not as competitive. But if you're looking for someone who's maybe an HR generalist, if you're looking for someone who is an accountant, if you're looking for one of those roles where, and I don't mean to say that accountants are specialized. I don't want to get a bunch of angry accountants messaging me on LinkedIn. but
they're passive aggressive. They'll be all right.
Yeah. I like accountants. I'm good. Let me put that out there. But you know, if your skill isn't super niche right now, those are the roles where I feel like it's really competitive. So that's like kind of almost like a non-answer, because that's a lot of different roles. But if you're a role where there, you know, there is a lot of people, it all comes down to volume. There are a lot of people who do what you do. Odds are a lot of them have been displaced recently. And that means you have more people who do what you do who are trying to find a job. It makes for a more competitive process.
All right. So I'm the hiring manager. I'm the leader, right? I'm looking at all of these people applying to my position.
Right.
It's 2021. What am I doing differently than 2020 or beyond or before that? Any changes that I should be making this year?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I would counsel, and I don't know if this is to their benefit long-term. This is kind of a long-term benefit, but you're probably going to have more people applying to your role, right? You're going to put that post out there. More people are going to come through. One of the things I would try to do is, one, be empathetic. There's going to be people who have been out of work. And normally you might be well within your right to say, hey, you know, what have you been doing? Why are you unemployed? You know the reason now. The vast majority of people who are out of work now, it's because of the pandemic. So I would, one, kind of understand the stress and the difficulty that a lot of the candidates have encountered. And I'd make sure secondarily that you're getting back to these people. It is so easy when you have a bunch of people apply to your role to not close a loop with some of those other people who you don't consider to be the candidate you want to hire. I would caution hiring managers because the long-term impact of that can be extremely negative. You know, those people have, you know, friends, contemporaries who are potential future candidates to you, and how you treat those candidates matters. You getting back to them, closing the loop, saying thank you, but no thank you. I think those things are really important. Those are two things I'd highlight.
Boy, there's a bit of a wicked echo here. So I wouldn't think that that would have changed too terribly much, right? Because whenever you have Glassdoor, you have ratings on Indeed and everything else. I think that candidate experience is much like the customer experience, or, you know, the customer buying journey. I see a lot of alignment between marketing and sales with recruiting and hiring. Is that kind of what you're saying? So just pay a little bit more focus on that.
Yeah. And I couldn't agree more with you, Brian. There's a lot of parallels there, but I think we also pay a lot more attention to customer experience than we do candidate experience. I think candidate experience needs to undergo a pretty significant makeover for most companies. So I do agree with you. It's always important. But when you have more candidates, when the volume is different, I think it becomes easier to not adhere to those principles of making sure they do have a quality experience.
Well, so let's play the antagonist, right? So why do I care? I got so many people out there. Why should I care what their experience is like?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'm sure that does go through people's mind. But what I would say is, imagine a year ago. Imagine what hiring a year ago was like. Right? You probably couldn't afford to not answer some of these people because you needed them. You know, those are people who you would hire, but now you have a surplus of candidates and it feels different. What about a year from now? What if the beginning of 2022 feels a lot more like the beginning of 2019 and you don't have that candidate surplus? The way you treat candidates now will matter in a year. The reputation you build, the after effects, the ripple effects of the candidate experience you provide during a time of surplus impacts you directly during a time where you don't have that surplus and you don't have the candidate flow that you need to build your team. So that's what I would say. I would say, yeah, right now, will it impact you? Will it impact you in 6 weeks? No. But will it matter 6 months from now? Yeah, very possibly.
Yeah, and I would think that also goes to what type of culture do you have? Because if you have that type of culture, I couldn't even imagine your leadership and management style. And the other thing that I've often heard out there is, you know, just never ceases to amaze me of, you know, hey, why should somebody work for us? Like they a lot of these, and I don't know if it still holds true, but a lot of these founders and owners would think, hey, you know, they get to work for us. It's their lucky day kind of deal. And they wouldn't care about the candidate experience because they think like they're doing that candidate a favor. Is that still out there at all? Or is that finally gone away?
Yeah, it hasn't gone away completely. I mean, I think there are certain, and I actually feel really strongly about this. So two things here. The first thing, you should always be selling your opportunity, right? As the company who is doing the hiring, you want to be the person who says, hey, thanks, but no thanks. We're going to go with a candidate who's more closely aligned to what we're looking for. You want to be able to say that. You don't want someone to back out of your process because they feel like, you know what, I'm just not intrigued. I don't think this is a strong alignment for me. So you always want to be selling. You want to be selling your organization, the upside, the non-monetary growth that the candidate will experience by joining your organization. All those things matter. And then my second thing on this is great candidates will always have options. So if you look and go, hey, it's a benefit for them to even be able to work here. We're doing them a favor. Okay, maybe that's true for some people. But the top performers, if they're interviewing with you, they are interviewing with other companies. And if you're not selling them, if you're not showing them why, if you're not demonstrating the employee value proposition, EVP, why should you work here? they're going to go with one of those other opportunities. The best people always have options.
Yeah, it goes back to another thing that I wanted to raise is, okay, so the best performers, these top 25%, which I want to touch back on that again, but the top 25%, they can go anywhere. Even if, heaven forbid, they were fired, if they're top performer, they're going to go somewhere else and get that position. So what should my hiring process look like? So I would think that I need two almost diametrically opposed things to happen. One is I need a robust vetting system, but two, I need speed of process so these top talent people don't go somewhere else. So one, is that understanding correct? And two, how do I walk that divide?
Yeah, that, I mean, you hit the nail on the head with number two, for example. If you ask any of my clients, they probably will tell you, I repeat that all the time. I say, time kills all deals. I learned that in the first day of recruitment. It is true today as it was 11 years ago. You want to move quick. I always tell people the longer your process takes, the higher the probability something terrible happens, right? They get promoted to their own job. Another recruiter reaches out to them, especially with the best people. They have options. So yeah, absolutely. You want to move quick. Provide a great candidate experience, right? Clarity and communication. Let them know when the next step is happening. Let them know you're interested. If a long period of time, and that's obviously relative, but if an extended period of time goes by and you're not communicating to them, what do they infer from that? They infer your lack of interest. So clear communication, speed and process. Of course, you want to be thorough, but then remember to sell those candidates. Remember to sell them on why. Why do they want to be here? What's the upside? That's like kind of a trifecta, right? Make sure you're doing a thorough job. That's important. Hiring the wrong people is incredibly expensive. Make sure you're moving quick. And then remember to provide a good candidate experience where you're selling.
Yeah. So now going back to the vetting side, that's going to tie into that 25% of top performers. You gave us 25% of top performers. You said guarantee, you use PI, aligned values and performance kind of thing.
Yeah.
Different language, but that's kind of what you said. But are you identifying where to go hunting for those top 25%? I mean, if I'm an owner, I want you to validate that because, you know, that's a bold claim. That's top quartile of all employees.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a bold claim. It's a good question. I would say that the key there is understanding what it is you're looking for, right? Because the top 25% of talent looks different depending on what matters to you. So it all starts with having a really great kickoff, right? And having a discussion in which we dig deep into what matters to you. What are the absolute musts? What are the nice to haves? What are the 3 to 5 things you need this person to accomplish in the first 365 days for you to say, yes, that was absolutely a success. They met their goals. They accomplished their objectives. This was absolutely, unequivocally a great hire, right? We need to find out what those things are because depending on what those things are, that's going to dictate where you go look. You know, we start a lot of our searches on LinkedIn, right? And going out there, 25 years ago, recruiting firms had their little Rolodex and that's where they kept their best talent. We actually go out there to the market based on what you're looking for. We put together Boolean search strings, and then we're finding people who meet all the qualifications that you're looking for. And then we're aggressively pursuing them. And then, you know, we have those conversations. We find out if they are a qualified candidate or not. And when they are not, you know, we build a relationship and we leverage that relationship to get referrals, people who maybe don't have an online footprint. That's creating the pool. Once you have that pool of candidates, then you are using the process to identify top 25 performers. And a lot of it comes down to good old fashioned interviewing and recruiting, asking the right questions, picking out the patterns that determine this is a top performer, right? What is your most significant career achievement? How did you achieve it? What was your specific role in it? How long did it take? You know, and really digging into seeing the impact they've made at other organizations. And when you can find and determine that impact, then you're able to see the cream rise to the top and identify them as a top 25% performer. That's I said a lot there, but that's basically the process.
Okay. So basically it's, let's put it in selling terms. You identify your ideal, your ICP, but instead of being customer profiles, your ideal candidate profile. You find the target market, where to find them. So you're suggesting LinkedIn. You find the right list through your Boolean searches, if you will. So then now I'm still not getting the 25%. Forgive me for being a sticker on this, but how are you then? So we're identifying them. We know where they go. We've built up this pool, but then how do I still know that they're going to be top 25% compared to what?
Yeah. I mean, that's a good question. And you know, my answer would be that you do it. We do it personally using that process, right? Head, heart, briefcase. So when you combine, let's start with head, right? You use predictive index, you identify that they have the ideal pattern to perform in the role, right? Then you get their cognitive score and you see that their cognitive score, you can easily identify top 25%, right? National benchmark is 250. They come in at 350. They're in the top 25%, right? So in terms of ramp up speed, they're there. Then you go down to value alignment, right? We get your core values as an organization. What matters to you? How do we find people who share that alignment? Then we identify if they share that or not, right? So that kind of takes care of that. And then we look at their career accomplishments, right? Are they accomplishing things? Are they moving quickly? Are they being promoted? Do they have that achiever pattern? We feel that when you combine those things and you identify the alignment in all three of those areas, you can find that that person's a top 25% performer. A lot of it comes down to, in the briefcase, just identify what they've accomplished in their career, right? Are they succeeding at a clip that's more impressive than their contemporaries? You know, are they achieving things that put them in the top 25%? It's a combination of those three things. That's how we feel that we identify it. And then we back it with a 365-day performance.
Yeah, which is a pretty bold guarantee. Now let's go back to that cognitive score. So what would you say the difference between your PI testing and your cognitive testing is?
Yeah, so I need to put the caveat out here. I am not a PI expert. Now my company has PI experts, but I wanna make that like abundantly clear. So the personality assessment, right?
So that can measure... I pause you here if I might? So PI is an assessment tool out there People drink their Kool-Aid on whatever tool or assessment they're using. And there's some really good ones. So we use Outmatch on ours. We use PI. We've used Colby. We used DISC. We've used Divine. We've used Curlin. I mean, there's a lot of different profiles out there. Yeah. So I think one of the key things that you're saying here is no matter what, I don't care the assessment, you might, but make sure that you're assessing them. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's a good idea. And I think it's a good idea, though, if you use it the right way, and that's as a data point, not an end-all be-all, not a disqualifier, but as a piece of the puzzle. You know, and if you find because you're right, there are a lot of good assessments. We specifically like PI and how it's used and the way you can use it post-hire for onboarding and then teaming. But yeah, use it as a piece of the puzzle. It's a data point. It's part of the process. I would say there's value there, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's a really key point is it's a data point. You have to look at the whole entire picture and you can't, you know, because that's going to be a snapshot. I think predictive index is a snapshot over 4 months. Some of the other ones are 3 months or 6 months, you know, but they're going to be a snapshot. So take that all with a grain of salt. Use it, but then allow that to be the X-ray MRI to really dig down more deeply, which then goes into so let me go back to understanding full well that you're not a PI expert. Difference between the PI and the cognitive, just high level.
Yeah. So the behavioral pattern, that's basically it's a reading of your tendencies as a human being and when you perform in a role, right? So it talks about your drive, your need for dominance, your attention to detail, you know, how outgoing you are, things like that. So it measures those behaviors. The reality is, if you're a salesperson, certain profiles are going to be way better than others, right? You want to see that maverick or that captain, those people who have a high drive and maybe a little bit lower attention to detail because you want them churning and burning a little bit and getting after it. Whereas if you're an accountant, we go back to accountants. This isn't a negative accountant. But accountants would want a very different, right? The attention to detail in someone like me and someone like an accountant is very different. And it should be that way. So that's the top part of predictive index. The second part is a cognitive score. And we basically, that uses the assessment they use for the NFL. You know, it's a 12-minute timed assessment. And then you're assigned a score. And you can kind of benchmark, like here's the national average is 250, right? It's on, I think it's, it goes up to like 450. And you can say, you know what, for this role, it's very technical. It's very complicated. We're going to throw a lot of things at them. I'd like to set the benchmark at 270, a little bit higher than the national benchmark. And then right there, you get, okay, we can measure the speed at which they ramped up. It's not an intelligence test, but it does measure how quickly they can ramp up and how quickly they can learn, which is really important in entry-level roles and complex roles.
Interesting. Okay. So then we take the assessments, we take the cognitive score, we benchmark against that. Now, you also talked about interviewing practices or being a really good interviewer. So what are some key tactics that we should do during the interview stage?
Yeah, so we're a big fan of, getting questions asked that, I mentioned one earlier, right? Like, tell me about your most significant career achievement, right? And then breaking it down into, the different aspects, what they learned, individual contribution, but really breaking that down so you can see what a person has accomplished in their career. Now, we're a big fan of, behavioral interview questions, because it allows people to tell a story and relate it to past experience. And it gives you a snapshot into what they've done. So you can imagine what they can do for your, for you or for your client. We also use, and not to harp back on PI here, but one of the things that we do is PI actually spits out questions that addresses misalignments. So to go back to that sales role, let's say you wanted someone with a really high drive. That's a natural thing to want for a salesperson. But let's assume instead of this person being in the, all the way to the right, like a very high drive within the top, 10 percentile or whatever, is more at the midpoint. So PI will then spit out questions that help you address those misalignments. So it's a combination of a lot of things. We ask about all of it, right? We ask about the misalignments. We ask about the values because we feel it's really important to find value alignment if you can. And then we talk about their career achievements, what they've done, asking behavioral interview question. And it's kind of the combination of all those things. We have a scorecard, actually. So at the end of that, we kind of rate them on a bunch of different competencies that are related to those three different areas. Not everybody can do that. Everybody doesn't have access to all that. But that would be where I'd start.
Right. But you should have a scorecard, right? Because unfortunately, if you don't have that scorecard, you're going to hire people that look like you. You're going to hire people that you like. And meanwhile, if you're an outgoing, gregarious person and you're hiring for a coder or an engineer or something like that, you don't want an outgoing, gregarious coder or engineer because they're probably not going to have that attention to detail that you need, or the patience to dive down deep into solving very technical problems. So you have to know what you're looking for, and that scorecard can really help. Also, my sense is that it's going to drive out bias. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I mean, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, if you just hire and you just go, hey, I'm just going to haphazardly go about it and hope everything works out well, you're going to hire a bunch of people that are really similar to you. And that does nothing for diversity of opinion, and diversity of thought. And it does nothing for balance, right? I have a very low attention to detail. I'm going to put this out there and just admit it on your podcast here. I have a low D trait on PI, which is fine for my profile and what I do. But to have my team have balance, I like to hire people who do have a higher attention to detail to me because I want balance. So I think it's really important to have that scorecard so that you can go through and actually pragmatically decide who to hire based on the competencies that are important to effectiveness in the role. Right. And if you just go, hey, I'm just going to hire people, you're going to hire a bunch of clones of you.
So let's go back into, hiring.
Yeah.
So many people make so many mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, and it is so costly to have a bad hire because not only is it the recruitment costs of a bad hire, the advertisements, if you're using a search firm, it's the labor hours of if you have an internal recruiter or your interviewing team. I mean, it's all of those costs plus a hard cost of any technology that you might be using, whether you're using video on demand interviews, whether you're using these assessment tools like you're talking about. I mean, they're tens of thousands of dollars whenever you start to put these packages together. So that's not an insignificant investment, the applicant tracking system and all that good stuff. So, all of that said, 1.5, 2 times, my goodness, you see the higher up in the organizations, you see 5 to 7 times salary cost of a bad hire. So if all of that is true, that, even if it's a $30,000 a year higher, you know, fairly entry level, that's a $15 an hour hire. That could have a potential negative impact of $30,000. And you're probably not hiring a lot of $15 an hour people unless if you're a restaurant. So all of that said, why in the world are people not paying more attention to this and learning how to hire better?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've seen very similar numbers. I think if you're talking about a standard role, like not C-suite, I'd say 0.5 to 2 times is the likely cost of a bad hire, right? So in this example you gave, that's $15,000 to $60,000. That is not insignificant. I think it's because most people don't know how to hire. There's not like a training course. There needs to be more management training, in my opinion, in corporate America. And I can't speak for other countries, but in corporate America, there needs to be more management training to begin with. But in addition to that, I think most people, they assume, okay, you've made it to this level, you know how to hire. And they don't. They don't always know how to hire. So you've got a bunch of people who are going out there who are ill-prepared to build a team, some often for the first time, and now they're building a team and they're going about it in what they consider to be the best way, but they just don't have the experience or the knowledge or the know-how. So I think a lot of it comes down to just, not knowing how to do it. You talked about the bias, people just going about hiring people that they feel are like themselves. One of the biggest contributors to people leaving an organization is just being hired into the wrong seat. And I think a lot of that comes from not knowing how to, properly interview and hire. So I think there's so many factors, but that's
so
a big one.
Yeah. So if they're hired into the wrong seat, is it, I don't know how to interview and hire, or is it back to that? I don't know how to identify the ideal candidate profile. Maybe I don't have the right job description. Maybe I don't have the right expectations and metrics laid out to let this person know what they're doing. Is it more on the, I don't know, the front end planning side of it, or more along the lines of, I don't know how to interview and hire?
Yeah. Can we have both? I think it's one of those things where it really is going to depend on the situation. I think there's a variety of contributing factors as to why people make it on hire. But certainly inexperience in hiring or not knowing how to do it properly is a big one. That bias hiring for people who you like and who are like you, as opposed to people who are qualified and capable of doing a job, is a big one. There are a lot of reasons. So it's hard for me to pinpoint just one. That's one of those things where there's a lot of reasons.
Now, any suggestion of, okay, so that you keep talking about cultural alignment, and I wholeheartedly agree, right? So you have to have talent alignment, cultural alignment, and I would say even passion alignment. Do they like what they're going to be doing? Do they like the mission of the organization? Right. So there's all of this alignment. So talent, talent, culture, and passions have to come align here. So how do we vet for culture?
Yeah. So I think the most important thing here, and that I like to say value instead of culture sometimes, because I feel like culture, people have a tendency to culture themselves into an echo chamber and they want to get a whole bunch of people who are just like them. It's a bit of semantics here, but I like saying values, right? And the first step is identifying the values of your organization, right? What matters to you as a whole? Is it integrity? Is it passion? Is it excellence? So I think the first step is clearly identifying those. Right. And if you just, if you just have 4 or 5 words and you put it on a poster and you put it on a wall and that's all you do with your values and culture, then you don't have a culture. You've got a poster on a wall. So I think it's important to identify them, things that matter to you, and then live them, and then hire around it, review around it, grade people around it. It needs to be something that is actually real. But once you identify those, so say you identify a set of, values and they matter and they're real to your organization, then I think it needs to be part of the interview process, right? And how you do that is going to depend, but, you want to ask questions around it and actually dig into it, not just assume, So when I'm building my team and I'm hiring for my team, I'm asking questions around it. We actually have a values exercise where we have people go out and connect with different people in the company and talk about our different, our values and what it means to them. And then we have them actually put together, a writing assignment on it. We're talking about, okay, I connected with Ben and we talked about passion. What does it mean to me? And how do I feel like that would be a good alignment with, you know, with me personally? So I think there are a few ways to do, you know, to do it and go about it. But I think you need to clearly define it within the organization, make sure it's something that's real, that you live, and then incorporate that into some of the questions you're asking. That's where I'd start.
Yeah, and a great resource to go along with what Ben's talking about, I read it a while back called Culture by Design. I'm not sure if you've read it or not, but it's a really good exercise. So you take the core values that Ben's suggesting. So, you know, 3 to 5, I would definitely not have more than 7. So 3 to 5 is typically the magic number there. And then how do you put actions to it? So if it's passion, how does that manifest? Because passion might be different for everyone. So one of the things that we have is integrity, right? But that's integrity is, that is so subjective, right?
Totally.
So maybe whenever you say integrity, how do you identify that? Well, we don't give and accept excuses. We're not late, so we keep our commitments. So actually, we don't say integrity. We say we keep our commitments, right?
Yeah.
So it's show up on time. Yeah. Right. So if you can identify the key behaviors that manifests that value, then you can quantify and train to it and hold people accountable to that. Because if it's an idea, you can't really hold somebody accountable to an idea that I'm aware of. But if it's behaviors, you can visibly see those behaviors. How often are they doing them? And you can even coach, mentor, and train to them. So to take what Ben's suggesting, forgive me, I don't remember his name, but Culture by Design is the resource that I found very helpful there. So exactly it. Now,
you nailed it too. Real quick, it's define it, right? That's the key. Define it. What does it mean to you and your organization? Because so one of ours is integrity. And we define that as you do the right thing when no one's looking, right? And so it's just defining it, right? What does it mean to your organization? And, I think, step one is finding things that matter to you and finding value. Step two is clearly defining them so you can actually, you know, monitor how people are adhering to those values.
Yeah. To piggyback up off of that one is defining it. It's already there. It's already in your organization. You might not like it. Right? So you might need to change it around, but it is already there. It exists. So a good way to identify this is, you know, get a small group together and, get maybe 3-4 people together that you know, like, and trust, that really eat, breathe, and sleep your values, and get them to identify who are all of the people that if they had, you know, 5 of these or 1, 2, or 3 of these type of people on the team, you could take over the world.
Yes.
And then 1, 2, or 3 people that you would, you know, are just disastrous that you hired. And then identify all the traits and characteristics that they had, and determine of those traits and characteristics, which of those do you want in your organization? Which ones do you have in your organizations? And voila, you have your core values. So that's a nice, easy exercise to be able to do that. Now,
preach.
Let's transition then. What are some of the biggest mistakes that prevent people from hiring well? I mean, what are some of the red flags? And I'll couch that down to interviewing, because that's where I see a lot of people messing up. But how do they vet poorly or interview poorly? What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see out there that, oh my gosh, if you could fix that, it would have such a big impact?
Yeah, there's a lot of things I could say about process. I could probably talk about process for 10 minutes, but one of the things I think is so important, so I'd like to start here, is defining the performance objective, right? You often, people say hire for culture, and me personally, I say, hey, that's important, but you don't hire for culture. You hire for somebody to do a job, right? You don't want to just hire someone who's fun to get beers with. I mean, ideally, they have that value alignment, they're a good fit to your culture, but you hire people to do a job. So if that's the end goal, then you need to clearly define what success looks like. And to me, that's performance objective. Right? So it's looking at it in a year. What do you need someone to accomplish in the first 90 days? What do they need to accomplish in the first 180 days? What about the first 365? Clearly define that with actions that are quantifiable, with clear outcomes. And then that's your baseline, right? Don't hire a job description, hire a person, hire somebody who has done things, accomplished things. And then you go out and you go, okay, this is what they need to do. Here's what we want from a value perspective. Here's what we need from a, you know, a must have and a nice to have perspective, and use that as the foundation for going out and identifying whether someone is a good fit for the job or not. So that's where I would start. If I had to say, hey, there's a lot of mistakes, but one of the big mistakes is I just don't think people look at, okay, what is successful performance? Let's clearly define it and let's go find that. I think that's a starting point. I think people look at a job description that may be 5-10 years old, sat on someone's desktop for a while, dusted off, and then they go out and they try to find, okay, 5 years experience. Okay, you know, a degree. Okay, you know, they have this. But what have they done? What have they accomplished? And can they accomplish that for you?
Yeah, it's kind of curious, right? Because you're talking about your lack of attention to detail. By the way, guilty myself. that's why I'm in sales, right?
I assumed.
Yeah. But the thing is, if you look at most job posts, because they're written, and don't get your cackles up here, but they're written by HR people that haven't gone into sales, or they're written by the founder or the chief operating officer or the CFO, right? All of those people are typically high attention to detail.
Yeah.
And so they say, we want you to have detail so you can fill in the CRM correctly, right?
Right.
And like, that's the most important thing. Yes, we have to do that. However, you want to make sure that what the most important roles are, ROLESs. So I'm from Pittsburgh. We say role that you follow, role that you lead, that you perform all the same. But that the top 3 to 5, 6 roles that you're performing, if you can't put a number to it, probably not a role. So how do you define, right? I can't measure attention to detail unless if it's a highly important, you know, if I'm writing code, then I want to say less than blank percent error rate from attention to detail. I can measure that, right? So you really have to look at it, and then it goes back to what you were suggesting earlier, scorecard for candidates, but also goes to job scorecard once they're there. So all of these things really align. There's nothing new under the sun here. Okay. So one best business hack or for talent that you might have for us.
You said one more time, what was that?
Yeah, sure. One, like a business hack for hiring, a business hack for talent. What, if you would have us to do one thing, what would it be?
Oh, man, that's so hard. I wish I had like three one things. So I would say if you could do one thing, and I'm gonna pick something that I think most people don't do a good enough job on, so it would have the most value to people listening. But develop your EVP. That's your employee value proposition, right? So when you think about your role, why would somebody who is not looking for a job, who is a top performer doing what they are currently doing, clearly establish why they would want to come work for you? Why is your opportunity superior? What is the non-monetary upside? Make sure you know that, you are familiar with it, and you're able to pitch that to candidates. And then go quickly. So I took 2. Make sure you move as quickly as possible. Try not to take forever. You're going to lose the best people.
So with that said, I thought I had all of my stuff shut off. So apologize to the listeners for stuff moving. I don't know how to unplug this. So whenever we're talking about the EVP, the employee value prop, what are some different examples? Because my sense is it's likely going to be different per role.
Yeah.
Because, okay, so can you describe that a little bit more?
Yeah, so it, you know, you have to think of it like in for the person, right? Whoever it is you're trying to hire, that lever is going to be different. You know, every different people are motivated by different things. But let's take example a developer, right? Because we've used that example a few times. If you are working with cutting edge coding languages, right? Like, you know, not antiquated, old, but stuff that's going to help them grow as a person, that's a component to EVP. If you have a direct line of sight to the next role, hey, we want you to come into this role, you perform it well, in 6 months, we'd be looking to make you a lead. That's EVP, right? It's clear growth. If you have a company that says, hey, we pay for 1 week a year for you to go out and volunteer for it with an organization that matters to you, and that's not part of your vacation, that's EVP. So it's finding what matters to people, right? It's what matters to the type of people you are trying to hire, what would be exciting to them, identifying it, and make sure you talk about it, sell it to them. So you have to kind of think about what it is, right? Everybody's going to have different, you know, different levers. and you know, identify what's exciting to the type of people in the role. Ask your team, right? If you got five or six salespeople, say, hey, what's really cool about this role to you? And then let them tell you. Hopefully there are things that are cool about the role. If not, you probably have a problem to change some things, but you know, find out what's exciting and make that part of your pitch. There needs to be a pitch. Not enough companies do it.
Got it. Okay. Well, as we're winding down here, and I appreciate the insights here, we've gone over a lot of stuff. So thank you for that. Any resources that you might recommend, right? So how can we learn how to recruit, hire, find talent? How can, what resources might you suggest that we could do better?
Oh man, you know, that's a tough one. So my company does a lot of teaching on that. So we actually have a course that we can put corporate recruiters through. So we can teach them how to recruit. We have a performance-based hiring type of training we do. I put out videos on it. So I put out videos on hiring. So you could follow me on YouTube, Ben Talks Talent. I'm there and I literally put out 3 videos a week. And one of them is always about recruiting and hiring and onboarding for your team. I would say that, you know, those are a few resources. Otherwise there's literature out there. None come to mind off the top of my head.
That's all right. That caught you cold.
Call me. If you want help, call me. I'll talk to you.
There you go. Check out his YouTube, man. So what trends should we anticipate here in 2021 for hiring? Any sense? What's the market telling you?
Yeah, so it's interesting. One of the things that I think is going to be really intriguing in 2021 is the tug of war between companies who are bouncing back to 100% in-person work and those companies who have said, hey, flexibility works for us. We're going to keep some sort of blend of in-person and remote, and we're going to offer current and future employees more flexibility. Make no mistake, there are companies who cannot wait for September, let's say, where they feel like they can have all their employees back safely on site, right? They can have all the people, even the people who could do their job remotely, they want them in person. And then there are companies that are saying, hey, it's been proven. You know, we have it here, proof of concept. You can do your job from home. So we'd love you to come in 1 to 2 days a week, maybe, because we want you to be able to do team stuff. And there's stuff we feel just makes sense to do in person, but the rest of the days, do it wherever you want. Do it from home, do it from Starbucks. You know, do it from Florida, you know, wherever that is. So I think one of the trends that's going to be so interesting over this year is the wrestling match for talent that'll take place between companies who will offer flexibility and companies who want to go to the way it used to be. And then those companies who are going to be at a tactical disadvantage when it comes to hiring, who want to go back to how it was versus companies who are going to give people flexibility they've now come accustomed to. What do they do to offset the disadvantage they've now placed themselves into by not affording flexibility to candidates and employees? That's a trend that I'm just really interested to see how it plays out.
Any sense on what the candidates you're talking to are looking for? Are they looking for, hey, I'd like to stay at home? Are they looking, hey, I'd rather go back into work? Are they looking for that hybrid? What's your sense?
Yeah, it's so interesting because if you asked people in May, they would have said, so many people would say, I hate this. You know, I got my dog barking behind me. You know, I got my child doing Zoom school. I don't know how to operate this. But people have gotten used to it. I've seen so many people now who said, Ben, I hated it 6 months ago, but now I like it. So there will always be people who want to go on site. I would say more than ever before, by a massive delta, people want flexibility. And if you're not going to give it to them, be prepared to give them something else. Compensation, vacation, other perks. But yeah, people want it. People are going to want it moving forward.
That was my sense too. Well, hey, Ben, I can't thank you enough. So last question is this: who should reach out to you? How should they do it? And why should people reach out to you, Ben?
Thank you. So everyone should reach out to me, kind of the joking, but if you are looking to build your team and you're looking to hire and you want top 25% talent, please reach out to me. I'd love to have a conversation and kind of show you with visuals how we go about accomplishing finding you the best people available. And if you are someone who is a candidate, or someone who cares about your career, find me on LinkedIn and YouTube. On LinkedIn, I'm Ben White. On YouTube, Ben Talks Talent. I put out 3 videos a week. Most of them are designed to help you interview more effectively. So that's where you can find me.
Awesome stuff. Well, Ben, I can't thank you enough. I really appreciate it. So things are changing, right? You got to know what is your strategy going to be for on-site, off-site? Are you going to be a little bit of a hybrid? You got to figure out how can I ask better questions? Are you going to use assessments? Are you going to use scorecards? All of these different things. Let's take some application from today's topic and let's get after it. Have a great 2021. Hey, thanks so much, Ben. I really appreciate it. Be well.
Thank you.